Hi, everyone. I'm Deb Flaschenberg. Welcome to Yoga, Birth, Babies, a podcast produced by Prenatal Yoga Center. We will be diving into everything prenatal yoga, birth, and baby-related, hoping to inspire, educate, and empower you through your journey into motherhood. Thank you for listening.
Hi, everyone. I'm Deb Flaschenberg. I'm your host for Yoga Birth Babies. Thank you so much for listening. Before we jump into the conversation, the topic of the podcast, and I introduce my guest, I just want to take a moment just to give a quick shout out about the PYC 85-Hour Yoga Alliance Teacher Training. I am so proud of it. It has been going on, to be honest, I think it's like 13 years. Incredibly proud of its longevity. And we just finished off our fall New York City teacher training. It was a sold out training. And I'm just finishing off correcting the exams and watching the final classes. And in just a few days, I'm heading to Charlotte, North Carolina for another teacher training. We have a wonderful group of people there. And then there's still a few spots left for the Richmond, Virginia training. That will be in January and February. And then back in New York for the spring for the New York City spring training in March and April. And can you believe it? But we're already starting to look at the fall. I can't believe it. A year away and we're getting that on the calendar and getting the applications out soon. So if you are a yoga teacher and you're interested in studying the PYC methodology, please take a look at the program. It's very in-depth. There's homework, there's videos, there's podcasts to watch and listen to. Intricate manual that I keep growing and growing because I love to keep learning. So if this is where your path is headed, please take a look. You can find more about it at the prenatalyogacenter.com website. All right, let's shift gears a little bit and get into the meat of the podcast. So I have Yali Shulansky. She's not just a community member, but she's my friend, and she's been with us for two births. So the podcast is going to be a little bit about her pregnancies, but what's so unique about Yali is how open she is about her past. She has suffered for 10 years of her life recently with an eating disorder. And if you can imagine, anyone that doesn't even have a issue or really or odd relationship with food, having to navigate pregnancy and the change of your body and postpartum. And then we layer on when there is a difficult relationship with body image and food and what that's like. And Yali so bravely opens up about her struggle with it and how she combated relapse with her eating disorder. And she's just so open to share her story. So I hope you enjoy this story. And if you are in this place of having a challenge during your pregnancy or postpartum with an eating disorder, I hope you can seek help. And I hope this helps give you that next step to take to find that help. And you might be the person supporting somebody that's going through this. So again, I hope this helps you and serves you. So without further ado, I'm so excited to speak with Yali. Enjoy. Hi, Yali. I am so excited to speak with you again. Not that I don't talk to you on a regular basis in class and online, but and through text and et cetera, but I'm really excited to have you come back to the podcast. So those that are maybe listening already in the community, Yali was my second podcast. My first one I did was a little bit about the studio. And Yali, you came to my house for that. Is that correct? Or am I making that up?
No, I came to your house to interview you, actually.
Oh, okay. Like, I remember you at my kitchen table. All right. So then I did the podcast via Skype, I guess, that other time, too. All right. Well, I'm really excited to have you back because a lot has changed in your life since your first time. And I love having community members come and talk about their birth and their experience. And you do have a lot to share. I mean, everything from, as you and I already talked about, having two children to motherhood to, let's even see if I can pronounce it correctly, matrescence.
That's right.
I had to practice that one. To eating disorders and body image issues. So there's a lot that you can share. And I love dipping into the pool of our community because you guys have such rich stories. Everyone has a rich story. So I think it's important to share. So I kind of gave a very brief outline, but let's have you just jump in and tell a little bit about yourself.
Okay. Well, first of all, it's a real pleasure to have the honor to be back on the podcast. It's very exciting. As you know, I listen to all of them, some of them multiple times, and I share them with every new mother that I encounter.
Yay.
Sometimes on the street, not really. So my name is Yali, and I describe myself as a teacher, writer, and dreamer, and now mother, of course. I am a teacher. I teach 7th and 8th grade. It's a class that I created called Jewish Life and Practices Through the Spiritual Lens. And I also work with kids and adults, actually, independently to help them cope with depression and anxiety and any kind of stresses that come up during their lives or in the classroom. And I teach them little tools that they can use basically all the time. And that's evolved over the years. In my other life, I'm a mother to two amazing kids, Zoe, who is going to be 3 next week.
Oh, wow.
And Ellie, who's just about 3 months old. And I see myself as pre-Yali the mom and post-Yali the mom. And I was thinking about this yesterday because Zoe was with her grandparents, and I just had this thought of, if I didn't have my kids, I really don't know what I would do with my time. They're just incredible, and it's such an honor to get to spend this time with them.
That's beautiful. What did you do with your time before your kids?
I think I took a lot of Zumba classes.
I actually just took Zumba for the first time. Shay's YMCA program had an evening family night and had a Zumba teacher. And I'm like, this is fun. So that's what you did. Okay.
It's a lot of fun. I used to take like 9 or 10 classes a week.
Wow. All right. So that
and
is then, clearly.
And I worked also.
Yeah.
In addition to working and all that. But yeah.
So, okay. So
but
now
I think having kids helped me shape
your time,
and focus where I'm going.
Yeah. I think a lot of people can say that, you know, because it is a focus, it's a demand on time. And I think that's why a lot of people, when kids leave the house, you know, that whole empty nest situation, that's a dramatic turn in life. Gosh, I haven't done a podcast about that. Maybe it's not in our realm. But it's suddenly a loss of focus and time. So yeah, I mean, having these 18 plus years of children in our lives definitely creates a structure. And for some, I think that works really well. And for some, I think it actually can create havoc and chaos.
For sure. For sure.
So let's talk about your two different entrances into parenthood.
Oh boy.
So I can just leave it broad and open. Do you want to jump in at that?
Sure. Let me start with the pregnancies.
Sure.
The pregnancies were like night and day, two very, very, very different experiences. With my first one with Zoe, I was very active, just like in this one, but I also had almost no symptoms. I had a little morning sickness, and, you know, other than growing, I sort of felt kind of the same, but pregnant. And which was nice because I heard a lot of horror stories of what the first few months could be and how it could be later on. And with Ellie, the second time around, I had every single symptom you could think of. And for the entire time, basically from week 2 to week 38, with maybe like a 2-week break in the middle, I had everything all day, morning sickness and the metallic taste and food aversions and migraines and anything that you could read in a like one of those pregnancy websites, I had that. So that was kind of a shocker because I was expecting to, you know, just sort of
breeze
through the second time too. But I think it made the entrances into motherhood both times very different. Because the first time after Zoe was born, the actual taking care of the baby part sort of came naturally, but the healing, I think, took a lot longer because I wasn't used to not being able to exercise, first of all.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't used to having such hormonal shifts, really, with nursing and everything. And it took me longer to get back to feeling like I was somewhere in my body. But with Ellie, and I have to be honest, I started drinking coffee again after I had Ellie because
it's your second kid and you need to.
That was necessary. But with him, I felt like because I I don't want to say suffer, but because the second pregnancy was so that much more challenging, let me pick him up. I felt like afterwards it was a little bit of a relief.
Hi, little man. I missed seeing yesterday in postnatal.
Yeah. Well, I missed you too, but Ursula and Allie enjoyed your macaroons.
Well, maybe they left me one. So entering motherhood a second time, we had the coffee, and I know that from what you shared with me, it seemed like your body felt better or at least more recognizable. Would that be a great way to say it?
So I think it felt stronger.
Okay.
It's kind of strange, actually, because I think I probably was physically weaker the second time around, since during my pregnancy with Ellie, I was sick the entire time. Mm-hmm. So after he was born, I actually dropped a tremendous amount of weight, like to the point where I was really taken aback by it and a little frightened, because of course you lose the baby weight and the placenta weight and all that other stuff, but I went way below what I weighed before I got pregnant with him, actually before I got pregnant with Zoe. So I think physically my body may have been like structurally weaker, but I felt more able to get myself back together than I did the first time. I think the first time I didn't, and I think I mentioned it to you the first time I went back to postnatal, I said, I can't hold myself up. I feel very, very weak. Mm-hmm. I didn't feel that the second time around.
Interesting. So, and you attribute so tell me a little bit about your first birth, because I do not remember it as well as your second, because your second was recent, so.
Oh, no, I remember the first one.
Yeah, I do. I'm saying I don't remember it. So tell me a little bit about your first.
So my first birth was a planned induction, because I was, I think, at 41 weeks and 6 days when we induced. And there really was no sign from my body that I was going into labor anytime soon. So my doctor, my care provider, strongly encouraged me to be induced. And it was a pretty standard, Cervidil, then Pitocin. And it actually followed their predicted timeline pretty well. Mm-hmm. I, of course, since my body did not go into labor naturally, the contractions were a lot more intense than I had, I guess, planned for. I don't know. But that was shocking a little bit. Just kind of get the build. I don't know. It was the build up into the Pitocin. And then while I was at some point in the labor, I started getting sick and I started getting stressed out that I couldn't breathe. And then so the baby couldn't breathe. And I had a little bit of anxiety there. But otherwise, I think I remember using a lot of visualizations the first time to pass through. And but then when it came time for her to be born, it was pretty quick.
That's great. That's really good, because you never know how, like, inductions can, not be as smooth. So I'm glad yours was. So tell me a little bit about your second birth.
So the second birth was an unplanned induction. I started having contractions at 36 weeks, and they told me that I was probably dehydrated, which was right. And then I started having contractions. He was born at 38 weeks, 2 days. So 38 weeks exactly, and they were getting stronger and stronger and stronger, and I was sort of following they're about 3 minutes apart, they're a minute long, they're really intense, I can't talk through them, it's time to go to the hospital. And I got there, and they put me in triage for a little while, and it turned out that I actually was not in labor, but I was dehydrated again.
Uh-huh.
So for those, the birthing parents that are pregnant in the summer, drink a lot of water. It was a very hot summer, and I was also working. I was teaching Zumba all the way through the end, so that probably contributed to it.
Mm-hmm.
But my care provider, who happened to be actually on call that weekend, It's funny, I actually had seen her that day for my appointment, and she said, well, you know, it doesn't look like anything's happening, but happened to be on call this weekend if you feel like coming in. So I guess I did. And she said, well, you know, you could go home and come back, but we're a little concerned because the amniotic fluid is dropping. And so after some discussion between, you know, with her and my partner and I, we decided that we would just induce. And she was very optimistic that it wouldn't take very long because the first time was more or less smooth. But from the first point of Pitocin until he was actually born, it was 27 hours. So it was a much longer time with Pitocin. To the point that, you know, like really nothing was happening for hours and hours and hours, and they just kept increasing the amount. And I really have to say I'm very grateful to my care provider because she's very, very patient. And she, her philosophy is, you're okay, baby's okay, we keep going. There's no need to rush into anything if everybody's fine.
That's great.
And she really, and she doesn't panic. She's not a, you know, she doesn't catastrophize, so... I think there were some moments during labor that things were happening because they sort of came in nonchalantly and were like, oh, we're just going to give you some oxygen now, no big deal. But everything was, you know, in the end, everything was okay. And he came out, he also came out pretty quickly when it came to that point.
That's great. So how did you mentally and physically prepare, and what was the role of education in your birth or births?
I think I said this the first time, and I say it all the time, and I'm going to say it again. Coming to classes, and particularly your classes at PYC, was a huge part of my education because either you would mention things that I hadn't thought about, and then I would research them further, or you would talk about them in class, and it really helped me shape how I went into the births, and I feel like I went in a much more informed and educated pregnant person, and I was able to ask questions. I think I asked anything that we spoke about in class or that you mentioned, I asked about either in my appointments or during the labor, or I had my partner ask about it. And I think it was very important because it allowed me to make decisions in moments where if I didn't have information or I didn't know what was going on, I might have panicked or I might have gotten stressed out, but I didn't experience any of that kind of, I don't know what's going on, because I knew what they were talking about when they said, you know, when they talked about stations or when they talked about positioning, it was as though I had been trained in, you know, in midwifery or something.
That's amazing. So a little bit deviating, because this made me think of as you were speaking, I thought of something. So coming to class, you know, we do interweave a lot of childbirth education into our class. It's actually one of the three main staples. I call them the pillars of our teaching methodology. But so that helped inform you and educate and create a curiosity to support yourself. What was your perception of birth prior to that? Because you did get the education and the new information. When you walked in the door your first time and before learning all this, did your perception of birth change? What was your thoughts of it prior to learning?
So all I really knew about birth was from my mom's telling me of my own birth, which was it was an emergency cesarean at 2 weeks post due date, and I was breech and she was narrow, and it was sort of traumatic. That was her experience of it. And, you know, I was the first one of my friends really to have kids, and I'm the oldest in my family. So I didn't, and my sister-in-law had kids before me, but she also had, C-sections. So that was sort of my nebulous knowledge of birth. Now, I will make a shout out to another podcast of yours, because I was taking, at the time, I believe I was taking Orly Athan's class at Columbia.
Yes, she's amazing.
Her class is, I think, now called the Mother-Child Matrix. It may have been called that then, too. But it basically goes into the experience of becoming a mother, about the mother. I think there's maybe half a lesson on the child, and the rest of it is cultural, social, psychological, and physical, the whole evolution of the mother, which she calls matrescence. And so that, from that perspective, I had some education, but I really, like, I didn't have any knowledge of birthing today, birthing in America, because I actually was born, in Israel. So my mom's experience was in an Israeli setting, you know, 30 years ago. And so I really, you know, and I think what, after I'd walked in the door and after you sort of did the circle time, I really thought like, wow, this is a good place to come, because I'm going to learn a lot. Even, you know, in addition to the yoga, I'm going to learn about what I'm about to go into a little bit.
Yeah, that's something I think I personally took for granted until I started diving deeper into people's personal history and what that means. You know, you've listened to the podcast, you know, I grew up with a very positive story of my entrance into the world. My mom was like, you're almost born on Storrow Drive. That's kind of like the equivalent to the West Side Highway for New Yorkers. And my dad asked to stop for a sandwich and she's like, no, the baby's coming out. And like, it was just such a quick, positive experience in her mind that mm-hmm. that is what impacted me as birth. So it did, for years, I hadn't realized that the history we're told about our birth has an impact on how people perceive birth. And then we have society and movies and friends mm-hmm. and everything telling us about birth. So many people walk in terrified without even really thinking about it. Just their subconscious is terrified of birth, or it's just negative, or they already feel invalidated in their ability to give birth. Like the fact that you said, like, my mom was narrow and I was an emergency C-section, whether they're realizing it or not, there's some part in your brain that can think, I'm probably like, I will probably have the same thing. So part of our jobs at the studio is to unpack some of those thoughts and baggage and history and try to smooth it out a little bit and hopefully create some encouragement that each experience is different. So I'm glad that you were able to find that inspiration and courage for your births.
Yeah, it was essential. And also, I mean, I also went in with a little bit of fear, because I struggled with a pretty severe eating disorder from the age of 16, really until the age of like 26, 27, until I started really, really getting out of it. And I was told many times over that I would not even be able to conceive kids. So having kids, actually physically birthing the kid, I was concerned that, oh, maybe I will be too narrow also, or all sorts of things happened, or, you know. So that was a big unknown for me, which I'm very grateful ended up not being an issue.
Well, let's turn that direction a little bit, because I know you and I talked about going into this, and I'm sure you're not the only one that has had body image and eating issues. In fact, I did one podcast on eating issues and another one on plus size expectant parents. So let's unpack that a little bit. So can you talk a little bit about how body image and eating disorders, how that might have been challenging during your life during pregnancies and postpartum?
Well, so the first time around with Zoe, I loved being pregnant, and I loved seeing my body grow, and I felt very empowered by the fact that my body could hold and nurture life, that she was in there and she was growing, and it was my body that was, and the way that I was taking care of my body that was allowing her to do that. That was a very empowering pregnancy for me. And it was a turning point in my continued healing, because it allowed me to sort of really tell myself, okay, so all these doctors told you wouldn't be able to have kids, but look, here you are, you're, you know, 11 months pregnant. That's what it felt like by the end. And you're okay, and you're going to do this, and it's good. At the same time, I worked very closely the first time around with my very longtime therapist, who had helped me from the beginning, And I paid very close attention to my nutrition and what I was eating. And I believe it was treated as a high risk pregnancy because of my history, but it didn't feel like it was being treated that way. There wasn't any, again, my care provider is very good at not making things seem very like catastrophic. So mm-hmm. it was good. Something that I made sure to do was also I would tell the nurses every time I went in, and my care provider knew that I didn't want to know numbers. I really, unless the weight was too low or too high, just don't tell me how much I've gained. Don't tell me how much I weigh. Let me just feel my body the way it is, because part of the eating disorder mentality is really focusing on numbers, whether it's calories or weight or BMI or whatever, and trying to sort of beat an imaginary goal that is not healthy. So really being in tune with my body and definitely exercising. Now, you know, every pregnant person is different. But for me, exercising throughout my pregnancy really helped me maintain that mental balance as well. And just doing my best to be in tune and eat as well as I could.
Do you want to take a pause? Do you need to take a pause and help him? Or is he good?
I think he just wants to be part of the conversation.
Oh, okay. Okay, cool. This is why we have Eddie who can always adjust things.
So the second time around was a lot harder. So first of all, I should mention that the second time, I think it was a little bit more challenging for us to get pregnant the second time around. There were a couple either false positives or something, I don't know, and it was emotionally a little bit challenging. I think, you know, if you remember, I was sort of like coming in and out of prenatal for a couple months. Mm-hmm. And so when I finally did get pregnant, I found out much earlier. So with Zoe, it didn't show up on the test until I was 6 weeks pregnant. With him, it showed up at 2 weeks. So already I was sort of thinking like, okay, maybe the hormones are stronger. But then the symptoms started. And that was challenging to feel nauseous and sick all day. And working as a teacher full time, you know, I'm standing in front of a classroom. I can't really like run out and leave a class of kids unattended. So dealing with that, dealing with not really wanting to tell anybody yet, mentally that was very challenging. And physically, I didn't feel good. I really felt crappy, if I can say that on here.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's the best way to describe it. I remember being pregnant, I had two miscarriages between my kids, and one time just like laying on the floor in Shay's room, just being miserable. And I think that adds to it too. Like you also have to take care of the other child.
Right. All right. The other child who, you know, who's a toddler. So she, and I was actually still nursing her at the time. So I weaned her when I was 5 months pregnant with Ellie because she just really loved nursing. And so it was very, very demanding. And I started to feel myself struggling. When I feel that coming on, my first instinct is to call my therapist. Even if I haven't spoken to her for years, I just call her and we have a chat and we see where I am. And the way I was getting through it was like, well, it's morning sickness. It'll go away at 12 weeks. I'll be fine. It's okay. I can get through this. And then when it didn't go away at 12 weeks, and actually I think around that time is when it started becoming all day morning sickness, like really just at a few points, it was like every few hours. Then it was a lot more challenging, and I hadn't told anybody at work and I think it definitely affected me. I felt like I was fighting a lot more the second time around to get through the pregnancy rather than really enjoy it. Mm-hmm. And I think when I hit 20 weeks, I was like, okay, I'm ready for the end now.
And you still had a long time to go.
And, you know, being pregnant through this very hot summer that we just had, and working and this, and And part of it was also, I knew that if I kept my mind busy and myself engaged, I wouldn't have time to sink into, oh, I feel terrible. Oh, this is definitely affecting the baby, and so on and so forth. Because that downward spiral is what can re-trigger a lot of things. And I struggled. For me, it was sometimes I had, in an eating disorder mentality, you have this voice that tells you what you're doing wrong all the time. And so part of the time was really, it was sort of saying, oh, are you really throwing up because you're nauseous from the pregnancy? Or are you doing it on purpose because you don't want to gain weight? And that was hard to deal with. And it was, and I actually don't think I have shared that with anybody before. So
Wow. There
you go. But it's important for me to share because I think it happens. And I think it's really hard to deal with the shame that comes up around that. The first time around, everyone was worried that I would relapse into my eating disorder, and I didn't. And the second time around, nobody even asked about it, and I was struggling a lot more.
Did you voice that to your partner, to your therapist at the time?
I spoke about it with my partner, but part of me also didn't want to worry him too much. So, that's also sort of the same eating disordered thinking where it guides you to hide the behavior and hide the thoughts and hide the feelings. So it becomes your little secret. Mm-hmm. But I would talk about it with him, and I would tell him, like, I really don't feel good and I'm scared. And, and he would check in with me, and we've known each other through, I would say, some of the hardest parts of my recovery. So he knows how to be sensitive around it and how to really take care of me with it, which was helpful. With my therapist, when I felt it very, very strongly and I felt like I had no way out, I would send her a text, and then we would check in either by text or she would call back. But for the most part, I really felt like I was dealing with it on my own, especially throughout the school day and when I was at home with Zoe. And it's very hard to explain to a two-year-old why mommy's running to the bathroom. And I'm very, very, I'm very aware of not wanting her to be exposed to eating disordered thoughts or behaviors. And she will be eventually because it's unfortunately part of our conversation. But at this young age, like, I didn't want her to make that connection either between being pregnant and feeling terrible or eating and throwing up. It just was, so that was in my mind as well while I was going through it.
What kind of things did the therapist or your husband say as a check-in? Like, what did that look like?
Well, my therapist is very big on compassion. Her approach to everything, which is what really helped me, is dealing with anything that happens in your life really with compassion and asking yourself to really check into where you are with it. So when something would come up and I would say to her, I'm trying to think of a specific example, but I think so around week 15 or 16, the nausea and sickness stopped for 2 weeks, and I felt amazing, and I started running again, and it was great, and so excited. And then at week 18 or 19, it came back with the same or worse intensity, and I think I felt a lot of despair at that point, and I started thinking like, oh, maybe something's wrong with the baby and maybe, all sorts of things. And she would tell me to question the thought. She would say, first of all, is this a kind thought? Is this a compassionate thought that you're having about yourself? And almost 100% of the time, the answer was no. And then she would ask me to say, is this a true thought? Is this a fact? Is this something that is supported by medical checkups? Is this something that's supported by physical symptoms? Or, she would sort of take it out of my mind and into my body. And that really helped because every single time the answer was no. Every checkup, the baby's fine. Every, you know, I'm fine, baby's fine. Everything was going the way it needed to go. So that really helped. And with my partner, it was, you know, for him to give me the space to talk about it if I'd had a difficult day or if I'd had a moment that was really hard. That's really his strength to say, like, okay, well, you know, let's talk about it. Say what happened. Because I tend to not say what happened and just say, oh, whatever, I got through it. It was fine.
What were some of the tools that you used to combat a relapse?
Constant awareness and vigilance is sort of like I was aware of the possibility, first of all. And over the years, I've really trained myself to recognize and to question the thoughts that are coming up and to not believe everything my brain says to me. Because our brains, for the most part, are very good to us, but there are moments where they're not so nice to us and they like to make us feel ashamed or guilty of things that we didn't do. And so that helped me get through some of the hard moments where I would check in and say, is this true? Is this really happening? Where is this thought coming from? And of course, there are moments where I wasn't able to do that and I would believe the thoughts and I would just feel despair. And what helped was saying, I feel despair. I feel very sad. I feel very angry. I hate this. I mean, I think I said it to you a couple of times, like I'm really ready for this pregnancy.
Oh, you said that well before you were in that window to give birth. Yeah.
And it's a controversial thing to say because, you know, we're supposed to love being pregnant and love becoming mothers, but it's a every time.
I'm going to take that supposed to out and just say maybe society feels right. We should, but I want listeners to know that it's extremely okay not to like where you are at the moment because eventually something changes or you just accept it.
Yeah, well, that was supposed to in quotes. It was really supposed to. But you do come up with that societal pressure. And especially now that everything is on social media, you see people, celebrities who are pregnant and glowing and so happy and their pictures look amazing. And
well, they have a whole team to put that illusion forward.
Right, exactly. And so that gets into our subconscious, even if
absolutely.
We're the most self-aware and... and healthy person that we can be, it's very hard sometimes to ignore those messages that get in because they come up.
Yeah.
When we feel vulnerable, when we feel tired, when we feel sick, when we feel just done with it, they come up. You know, you're not good enough. I can't believe you're thinking about this. And yeah, baby, you should start throwing up on purpose. So these thoughts come up and the only way to stop them is to acknowledge out loud, either to somebody else or to yourself, that they're there and that they're not yours. They're not your own thoughts about your body. They are, in the eating disorder situation, they are disordered thoughts. They are coming from another place. And that's what helps me get through. And also reminding myself how hard I worked to get out of a place where I was very sick, to arrive at a place where I can be a mother and a teacher and a runner and a yogi and a partner and all of these things that I couldn't do before.
That is quite the path you've had. Wow. And I'm so appreciative that you shared that. So, you know, we've done these podcasts on eating disorders, but I'm so appreciative that you opened up because I think, you know, I think the other ones went to it more a clinical understanding of it, but you really opened up the raw emotion of what it's like to have struggled and to get to, not nice to get to the other side. I think it's, you know, it's always probably going to be there lingering in your mind, but like you have some, it hasn't taken you over. You got.
No. And it's a very hard battle. I mean, I read yesterday an article about a woman who she's a psychologist and she wrote about people with high function who are high functioning, but have a mental illness. And how most people don't believe that they have a mental illness because they can get through the day.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that mask of functionality is that you learn how to get through a day so people don't know that you're struggling. And that could actually be more dangerous to you because there's such a disparity between what you present to the outside and what you feel on the inside. Mm-hmm. And that's very big with eating disorders, especially because for many people, as they get smaller, people start to tell them, oh, you look so great. Wow. What are you doing? You must be on a diet or all these things. But on the inside, they're really suffering.
Yeah.
And I actually experienced that a little bit postpartum this time around because I did lose a tremendous amount of weight and I actually felt really terrible with it. I felt weak and scared for the first, I would say at least the first 6 weeks postpartum, and people were telling me, you look great. And I didn't feel great, but I didn't have the strength at the time to say, well, actually, this is not a positive for me at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So that's also a little bit of a disparity because in society, many people still equate thinness with beauty and health when really it's not always the case. And sometimes it can be masking something a lot, much harder and a lot darker.
So let's just say like today, how are you doing today?
Well, at least sleeping now. So
we'll check that box. Okay. Yeah. Well, you know, you're back to running.
Yes. So that was the big shift for me postpartum this time. Exercise is a part of my recovery. Like having a regular exercise routine, not overdoing it and really doing it in a way that's healthy, keeps my mind balanced. And I didn't realize how important it is to me until I gave birth to him and I couldn't exercise for 6 weeks. With Zoe, I don't think I felt that as much. This time, I really felt the difference. When I started, first of all, when I came back to yoga, and then when I started running, I actually waited. I texted you like from the hospital.
Do you remember that? I'm like, no, you cannot start. Like, didn't you just give birth a few hours ago? You cannot start anything right now.
Right. I actually waited more than 6 weeks. I think I waited eight weeks before I started running. And I started slowly, but I felt the difference immediately. My mind cleared, and a lot of these thoughts that were accompanying me postpartum and were making me feel very bad about what I looked like and how I'd gotten there, just went away. And I started feeling my body stronger again. What exercise allows me to do is to really, I don't have to think about food. A big part of eating disorders is you're thinking about food all the time, 100% of the day. Whether it's how little you're eating or when can you eat next and get rid of it, it's just it's in your mind all the time. And if I have a regular exercise routine, I'm more in tune with my body's cues of I'm hungry, I'm not hungry, than if I'm not. And that's just for me. I don't know if it's probably not across the board with everybody, but that's my own experience.
Can you talk a little bit about the exercise part of holding off till 8 weeks? I'm going to throw myself out there and say, like, while I don't strongly sort of the food, I'm a bit of an exercise problematic person that if I don't exercise, it gets me crazy. In fact, my husband's like, kids, let her ride her bike. She's going to be a wackadoo if she doesn't. So I was the worst example of what to do postpartum. I went back way too early after Shay, and that caused my body great harm. And I don't even remember how I did with Sage. That was such a blur. It was also a horribly cold winter. How did you hold off emotionally till 8 weeks of exercising?
I would think in my mind, what would Deb say?
Well, clearly that is not what to do, because I think I'm a much better giver of information than receiver of my own advice.
Well, I mean, part of it is what I learned through yoga and through your classes about the pelvic floor, actually, and understanding stability and how necessary that is to living.
Yeah.
And certainly exercising. And I actually, the first time I tore quite a bit, and the second time not as much, but it wasn't healing as well as it did the first time, and I could feel it.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, I was clear to exercise at 6 weeks, but she also said, like, oh, you know, it doesn't look exactly the way that I'd like it to look. And I actually had a procedure done at my 6 week appointment, which was really fun. And I thought, okay, so let's wait. Let's wait until I myself feel that it's a little bit better. And I'm glad that I did, because I don't know if it was, you know, she said it's not like structural damage, but let's let it heal.
Like the integrity of the muscle needed more support. Yeah.
It needed more support. It wasn't there quite the way that she wanted it to be. And, I by that point I'd gone back to yoga.
Yeah.
No, I went back to yoga like the day before that appointment, and I felt good in the class, and running is very high impact on the whole body. So I didn't want to risk anything. And I just kept telling myself, I have the time. I have the time to run. I have the time if I need. And I went back to work part-time, basically at 2 weeks postpartum. So I thought to myself, well, if I need to stretch that out, the part-time piece of it, because I'm not really fully ready yet, then I will do that. So I sort of gave myself allowances that didn't, because I also have that mentality that if I don't, you know, if I don't get my runs in 3 times a week, I start to feel a little crabby, and, you know, and my Zoe already says to me, like, Mommy, you really need to go for a run.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those things, to keep in check. It's so hard. Like, I really try in front of my kids not to express, like, they ask me why I exercise, and I don't want it at all related to body image, although I know that's probably the 90% of my reason. I tell them if it's about keeping mommy's heart healthy and that they want mommy to live for a long time and be healthy and active. So I'm trying to put forth that exercise is a healthy activity and lifestyle. But it is, it's one of those things, as anyone that's had any sort of body image issue, it's a hard, we want to, I guess, as you said, like, we can't 100% protect our children from it, but we don't want to expose them to that thinking so early.
Right. And we don't want to create it in them, which I think happens a lot, inadvertently and sometimes openly in families, where eating patterns or conversation about diets and body image and exercise trickle down, especially to daughters.
Yeah.
And they carry it on with them. And I'm very, very aware of it. I don't even like saying healthy or unhealthy food or good and bad food. I just sort of, you know, like, I know people who don't let their kids have any sugar or don't let their kids have any carbohydrates or any this or any that. And I just, you know, I'm trying to convey, you eat to make your body feel good and strong.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can around without getting, you know, without your heart hurting or getting tired, or and you feel, you know, you don't get sick often or all sorts of things, then I use that as markers of you're eating well for my kids. And I also try to model good eating habits, like we eat at a table, we don't eat standing up, and we all these sorts of things. But yeah, it's very, that's something that motherhood, especially being the mom to a girl, has made me very aware of, is just how I talk about my eating and my body, how I talk about exercise, what I model, and just a lot more awareness around the behaviors that we demonstrate and that we show in the house.
Mm-hmm. And it's amazing what kids pick up. My daughter loves to make up songs. She's 4. Was making up the song about being pretty. And I'm like, and smart and funny. And like, I kept trying to add words besides pretty. She's like, I'm the prettiest girl. I'm like, and supportive and compassionate. And even like some of the fairy tales books that we have, because she's so into Disney princesses, I'll start adding words. I'm like, and she's intelligent. And like, my husband's in the other room rolling his eyes. Like, I don't even say like happily ever after. I'm like, it's a false thought. Like, so it's a false dream.
Listen to the rest of their lives as what happened.
Yeah, so yeah, it is. It's interesting, the pressure, or not even pressure, just like what trickles down to girls. So yeah, I'm trying to be mindful of that. I'm glad you are too. So let's start to wrap things up. I want to talk a little bit about some of your biggest surprises of motherhood. What has that been?
Biggest surprise, that I'm good at it. That I enjoy it. I actually really enjoy giving up all of my time for my kids, as much as I grumble through it when it happens sometimes.
I think we all do.
No, and I think the biggest surprise and joy was being able to become a mother. That was really it. And then just every day with kids is a surprise. You know, Zoe is developing quite a sense of humor, and she's just hilarious. And she'll say things that have me rolling on the floor, which is such a joy to have, you know, on a random car ride to work where you're 10 minutes late and, you know, she's hilarious in the backseat. So there's some of that. And just also how important a community is. Because I tended to be, in my younger years, I tended to sort of be more like have like one or two close friends, or just, you know, sort of be socially introverted. But since having kids, during that time, we've made a lot of changes in our lives also around, you know, moving out to the suburbs. And I mean, we're technically still in the Bronx, but it's pretty suburban. And joining a community and really feeling supported with other moms around and other women and other people. And that has been truly wonderful.
Do you have advice you wish someone had told you prior to parenthood?
Do I have advice?
Like, is there advice you wish someone had told you? Like, is there something as you were going through it, you're like, oh, why didn't someone tell me about this?
I think, you know, I think as much as people will tell you that it's going to change your life, you don't realize it until it actually changes your life. What I do wish someone had told me, or maybe I'd heard it, but I didn't believe it, that a lot of your relationships will change prior, you know, the ones that you had as a single or a single person or a person without kids, those relationships, many of them will change if you are the first one to have kids. Or, you know, you have kids and other friends don't. And I think that some of that is, can be pretty hard when you have, you know, friends that you spend a lot of time with and see a lot. And then for one reason or another, it sort of fades away rather than what you expect is like, oh, everybody will be so happy for me because I have a baby and they'll all want to be around my baby. And that's not always the case.
Yeah, I can definitely attest to that. Yeah. I think, you know, especially if someone doesn't have a child, babies can lose their shiny cuteness pretty quickly if they start crying. Yeah. The non-parent is like, and I'm done. I'll see you later. Yeah. Do you have advice that you wish to offer new and expected parents that has really been important to you?
Yeah. It's what I always say to new and expectant parents that I know in my life, but it's get educated. Learn as much as you can about what's going on in your body and in your life, because it's not something we're taught in school. It's not something, you may not be something you're taught from your mothers or your parents, and you need to know what you're getting into. You need to know what's happening to your body. You need to know what questions to ask. You need to know all of the scenarios that could or might happen. Like when I went in for the glucose test, I knew what that was because I'd heard about it and read about it, and you wrote a blog about it, and like all of these things. Whereas if you go in and they tell you, oh, we're testing you for diabetes, and you don't know what's going on, that could be a little shocking, or, you know, anything else. But really just get educated, know what you're going through, listen to Deb's podcast. Seriously, it has so much information about anything, really almost every topic you could think of.
Thank you. I love them. As you know, I love doing these. And we've reached over 100, so I'm constantly looking for a new topic. So if you have some thoughts that I haven't covered something, please let me know.
Okay, I will. and then just also tell people what's going on. If you're having a hard time, if you're struggling, even, you know, especially if you have a history of anything where you've had a hard time, whether it's depression, anxiety, eating disorders, if you have a history of trauma, anything, either find a professional person to talk to or find a person in your life that you can talk to about it. Because it's very, very important to know that you're not going through this alone, for the most part. A pregnant person, hopefully for the most part, is not alone in her journey.
And that I want to add to that, if you don't mind. So you brought up, you know, the eating disorders and trauma. I think it's incredibly important if you've had that in your life, if you're prone to depression, anxiety, anything, that you pick a care provider that is supportive and empathetic and responsive to that. Because, you know, there's so many assault survivors and those that have had trauma that if there isn't a trauma aware approach, I'm guessing it can trigger, and during birth is not the time that you want your body to get into that state. So just putting that out there to the listeners.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, make sure that your care provider, I talk so much about making sure your care provider is aligned with your philosophy, but I think we need to take that a step further to make sure your care provider is supportive of what you bring in from your history and what you need, what kind of support you need.
Yeah, and that's another piece. Don't hold back your medical history with your care provider, because things that you think will not affect your pregnancy might affect your pregnancy. So in my first session with her, I spilled my life story to her, because it's important for her. She is the one in charge of monitoring my well-being and the baby's well-being throughout, you know, over a year. So it's important that she knows what I'm bringing in, what my body is holding in it,
mm-hmm.
other than the baby.
Wow, this has been set. I loved this talk. Thank you for sharing. Thank you for being so open. You know, I think it's so important because, you know, even though we all carry our individual story, many people have a similar relationship and can relate and can get courage and just that companionship, even if we don't know each other necessarily, you know, the community that listens. Just hearing someone else has gone through this can be encouraging. So thank you for being so brave and for just spilling it all and letting it all come out.
Sure. I mean, that's, you know, sort of my driving force behind everything I do is being connected and being honest. And I find myself when I'm listening to the podcast saying like, me too. I totally, and I realize that nobody can hear me other than, you know, the baby in the car.
So in my heart, I'm feeling it. Oh, thank you, Yali.
But,
so, is there, I know you've done some work. I know you have the I Am Project. Do you want to just say a little bit about where people can find some of the stuff that you do?
Sure. So the I Am Project is the culmination of all the work that I do with kids, and it can be found at iamproject.co. And, you know, they can also find a lot of my writing and things that I do on they can find me on Facebook, they can find me on Medium, and I also offer consultations and private lessons with adults and kids over the phone and in person. So feel free to reach out through any of those mediums.
Oh, I love chatting. All right. I will see you in class next week, I hope.
Sounds good.
All right. Thank you.
This has been an episode of Yoga Birth Babies, produced by Prenatal Yoga Center. You can catch us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Periscope. I'm Deb Flaschenberg. Thanks for listening.